Welcome everybody to the Mosaic Rooms. Thanks so much for coming to tonight's event. We're really pleased to have Vijay Prashad and Pankaj Mishra here tonight. I'm really excited about the next hour, and without making further ado, please join in welcoming the team.
Thank you. So there it is. Actually, we didn't plan very much of what we were going to do, but I thought it might be interesting to start a little bit on a positive and negative note. Start with the Indian elections results, which came today, if you're interested in those. And then I think maybe we should go into why these democratic countries are falling apart. And the ones, you know, which were there, Turkey, India, Egypt, blah, blah, blah. Egypt, is it a democratic country? Sure. Why are they falling apart? Maybe we can talk about that.
Sure. Maybe let's start with that.
With the democratic countries falling apart.
Yeah. I don't know. I haven't actually, you know, there is no old theory, as it were, that will explain every particular instance. But I think what is falling apart, let's try and be precise about what is falling apart. What is falling apart is perhaps a system of representative democracy, whose main institution is electoral politics. And what is happening is that particular forces in each country, Russia, Egypt, India, Turkey, Israel, they've found a way to use democratic institutions in order to advance their particular agenda. And of course, in the end, to undermine democracy itself. Now, this has happened several times in the past. So I feel that what it is showing is that representative democracy has become hollowed out, and we can go into reasons why it has happened. And so now it's producing these, you know, manifesting these pathological symptoms where it's become very easy to subvert them from within, to undermine them from within, to actually use democratic institutions for anti-democratic purposes. Mm. Which is what, you know, has been happening in India over the last couple of years, that you can actually come into power with majority support, claim a mandate for everything you do, whether it's installing your own men in cultural institutions, replacing important people in the security establishment, staffing it with your own men, overturning previous legal indictments, investigations, all for your own benefit, and keep claiming and keep sort of insisting that this is all being done with the consent of the majority.
Yeah, and attacking the media.
And attacking the few institutions that are actually, dissenting from this whole process, and say that these people are anti-national. They're not part of the majority.
I mean, the interesting thing, of course, is you can make the case that this has already happened in the West. I mean, look at the United States, where, I mean, is there a difference between Modi and Trump? I'm hard pressed to. I was trying to make a list of ways in which Trump and Modi are different. And of course, the societies that they will have to command are different. But their attitude to, and Modi is clever, he doesn't make outrageous statements personally. He has what they so politely call surrogates make the really offensive statements. Although there are times in the past where he said things that are quite outside the mainstream or the consensus of Indian nationalism. But there's something that's already, in a way, happened or is unfolding here as well. I mean, underneath some of these attacks is something that I think doesn't get talked about enough. In the Indian case, let's take that directly. Yeah, you're right. They come to power with, it's an oscillation. On the one side, you'll have these parties come to power as experts. So Manmohan Singh, I remember in the elections, when the UPA won the two elections, The way on the internet in particular his supporters would work is they'd send around his CV. I don't know how many of you got Manmohan Singh's CV, but his resume was circulated. Like, you know, Dr. Singh has the most amazing CV, we need a technocrat. That's one pole. The other pole in which they claim legitimacy is the strongman. You know, remember this time Modi, he had a 56-inch chest. Okay, I mean, I don't know if any of you took a measuring tape and tried to see what a 56-inch chest looks like. And how is that, you know, reason to elect somebody? Erdogan in Turkey is very similar. I'm a tough guy. I stand up to the enemies of Turkey, things like that. So there's an oscillation between, you know, being the expert and being the strong man. And in a sense, the mood of both of these ends up being anti-democracy. You know, I find that is something that we don't talk about enough, because what happens when they come to power, they then go and smash popular movements. So in India, the movement, the institutions that they've been going after with almost no press coverage is basically legislation from the 40s, which supports workers. Trade union legislation, you know, various protections for workers, they've been just going after these. And there's almost no press coverage. They get press coverage for the attacks on students, and, you know, because those are so public and disgusting. But this happens in the shadows. Because there's a broad consensus that, it, you know, these are anyway defunct.
Yeah, you know. Absolutely. And, I mean, I think a lot of the coverage, if they were to cover it, they would say, oh, we do need these reforms in labor laws, so it might even be justified if people take note of it. But I think the this syndrome of the strongman, the craving for authoritative figures, I do think in various political contexts, various national contexts, it speaks to a very palpable sense of weakness and sort of powerlessness that many people feel today, of having their lives determined by vast, opaque, impersonal forces. And I think the promise of strength, and this works at many levels, of, you know, promising to restore some certainties that you grew up with. You see that very powerfully in America with the old kind of white working class, which, you know, by any kind of orthodox Marxist analysis should be thinking of mobilizing, you know, very, very differently as a working class movement. But no, I think there is that sort of nostalgia for the time when America was great, when we produced things, when we manufactured things. And now all these jobs have been taken away and we need someone to come in and sort this out. In India, of course, it manifests itself differently in the sense of, you know, young people who've left off, you know, sometimes rural areas, communities within rural areas, the families, and who find themselves spiritually, emotionally adrift in the big town or the big city. So they're actually literally missing strong parental figures in their lives, you know, fathers, mothers. And in that sense, you know, a guy who says, I've got this 56-inch chest and I'm going to give you a job, sort out your problems, is immediately seductive. So I think, you know, there's so many of these kind of non-political, as it were, phenomenal play, and that's why it's so kind of bewildering and so complicated, is that our all, I think, political tools, I feel that are not adequate enough to understand, you know, so much of what is happening today.
Partly we are embarrassed to talk about these things. I mean, that's, there's a lot there. I mean, you know, intelligent people don't want to talk about the displacement of millions of people, their feelings of bewilderment. I mean, you know, this Trump slogan, let's make America great again, that's the slogan of Erdogan. I mean, he cloaks himself in the Ottoman Empire. He's built this giant presidential palace. You know, if you see photographs of the presidential guard, they're dressed in Ottoman clothes, standing there very regally as he greets foreign dignitaries. In India, let's make India great again. Let's go back to some Vedic time, you know. I mean, there is this incredible, I mean, you use the word longing. people want some kind of recognition.
Yeah.
And I think at some level, this is the flip side of the idea of reforms. That, I mean, even the managers of the system understand, perhaps better than we do, the critics of the system, they understand, or they're less embarrassed to acknowledge the fact that people want some feeling of belonging.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, you know, on the internet, people pass these pictures of the Ottoman guards standing there and mock it. But what do we offer as a counter to that, to feed that feeling of longing?
Yeah. And again, I mean, it has happened before. This whole sensation, which Marx brilliantly described, you know, the sense of all that is solid melting into thin air. Already in the 19th century, you saw people responding to that sense of, you know, things melting with some kind of a, you know, desperate urge to create something solid, you know, to find something solid in ethnic identity, religious identity, racial identity. Nationalism, of course, you know, was a kind of response to this sort of dislocation. So we've kind of forgotten that, and one reason why we are embarrassed to talk about this is that, you know, this kind of change, modernization, urbanization, you know, the rise of individualism actually creates these, generates these cravings for, you know, the past, paradoxically, the fact that, you know, people want to return or want to attach themselves to some fantasy of a past, that there was strength in the past, the Ottomans or the, you know, the ancient Hindus, and we had, you know, mastered all these sciences that Americans claim for themselves. This kind of feeling of, you know, superiority that we did this a long time ago. And I think, you know, one reason why they have become so attractive again is what existed in the 19th century, which was a socialist alternative, is simply not, you know, available.
Well,
and
you know, this idea that you talk about the longing, I mean, the socialist answer to it was, I mean, they wrote about it. Sorel wrote about the myth. You know, Ernst Bloch writes about the need for tomorrow. I mean, what's interesting is that in that phrase is the answer. They didn't look back. They said it's coming. Then what came was not really good enough, or maybe even worse than good enough. And it penalized you to think that there's a future.
Yeah.
And so now we are not only, we can't even go back to the 19th century, we are so heavily penalized that, I mean, how many people believe that there's a future? I mean, in a sense, I think most people in the world believe now that every day repeats itself, that we live in a kind of endless present, that, you know, you wake up in the morning, you do this, well, you know, tomorrow it's going to be similar. And, you know, I mean, people all over the world now are just craving for, they can't retire because that dream is closed off. So they're craving for some deliverance from this.
Well, I think, I mean, actually that is the biggest change, I think, that for the first time in 200 years, we cannot believe that the future would be materially present. Than the present, would be superior to the present. You know, the fact that once secularization happened, once we started to move away from older notions of transcendence or, you know, a kind of divinely ordained order, we invested our faith in progress, and progress either through socialism or capitalism. And the expectation that things would be better for our children or grandchildren. But if you take that away, then you are condemned to live in the present. And I think that explains the sense of claustrophobia and rage and resentment many people feel today around the world, is because they are deprived, they have been denied this faith in the future that has been so essential to everything, you know, to sort of... essentially creating a society, you know, why do you create a society so that, you know, it can serve future generations, a new political unit? Why do you create that? Because, you know, you're thinking of the generations to come. People spoke that language all the time. So this is really an extraordinary change. And I don't think we've kind of still, you know, come to grips with this extraordinary issue.
I mean, I agree with you. I mean, I think it's not only in the political domain, it's in the family domain. Because, I mean, you know, the old story with raising children is always that you sacrifice things for your children, you know, so that they can lead a life. Every generation wants their children to have an incrementally better life than them. Now, I think, I mean, yeah, maybe it's 200, maybe a little longer, but let's say 200 years. I think very many people don't feel that it's going to improve for their children. And I'm not even just talking about the West. You know, there's a lot made of the aspirant middle class in India. I think it's already saturated. You know, so I think that the feeling that you're sacrificing for your children, it'll get better, is not necessarily the case. Maybe if they go abroad, you know, become has been the dream actually for several generations, and that's foreclosing in the West. So now what happens? And that's a serious, you know, it's a, not only a social dilemma, but I wonder what it's going to do to family structures and how parents have, you know, dealt with the fact that they are being driven to the bone, you know, exhausted, working overtime, whatever, and then, you know, you know, how do you tell your kids? I mean, I remember as a kid, the whole thing was go study double time, you know, because and then you have to do better, and then you have to do better. There's a great scene in Amitav Ghosh's, what's that one, the Shadow Lines, where the mother takes the kid to the window, and he's having trouble with his studying, and she says, look out there at the slum. If you don't study, you will be there. And there's a super description. He says that, and then from the boy's point of view, the floor became a seething mass of frenzy. You remember that feeling?
Yeah.
You're studying for the class 10 exams, and the floor becomes frenzy. I don't know what this is going to do to family structure as well.
Yeah. But, you know, I have a question for you, but before I come to that, let me say, I mean, I think maybe this loss of a faith in the future is one thing that can explain a variety of phenomena in the world today, you know, from the attraction of an organization like ISIS to a lot of young people today, the attraction of strong men. I mean, I do think that these phenomena should not be, you know, considered separately. Mm. They should be seen as part of a larger mood. Now, there are many ways to describe that mood, but one way would be to say nihilistic, where, you know, God kind of died a long time ago, and progress is also in trouble. So the two kind of important sources of meaning in one's life, in human life, and those have been the two biggest sources of meaning. When they are undermined in quite this way, you have this particular mood. We've seen this over in the course of modern history in the last 200 years, in, you know, isolated places here and there. But I think the novelty of this phenomenon now, that we now see it manifesting universally. You know, there are some exceptions, of course, Japan or Thailand. It's interesting to also think about the exceptions that do not partake of this mood. Cuba is probably one of them.
Why did you say Thailand? What's the...
Well, Thailand, I mean, I suppose it's not as much of a clear-cut exception as say, Cuba or Japan, but Thailand, because of its kind of very weird politics, the role of the monarchy, and the fact that the monarchy still plays a huge symbolic and political role in the country. So its sort of social imaginary is, you know, constituted differently. But, you know, we can't say the same about its neighboring country. We can't say the same about Malaysia or Indonesia. But the question I want to ask is, I mean, as a man of the left, I know you've written a book about this. How would you critique the left today? What are its historical failures of responsibility, and what it can actually do to offer a new project, a viable project? You hadn't bargained for this, will you?
No, this is a real question, because if we're talking about you know, what is the left, let's say, broadly put, response to the anxiety of no future? You know, yeah, absolutely. The right-wing response is, I'm the strong man, I'm going to take the economy by the throat and make it cough out jobs. You know, that's basically the strong man's view. And it's, you know, it's not going to happen. We know that. It creates more desperation and futility, but that's one approach. So, but they do promise a future. You know, the technocrat also promises a future, but these are unrealizable futures. The third future we actually all share, which is, you know, I don't know, you know, that feeling that we actually are not part of history. I want to, we were talking about this earlier, you know, I want to go and visit, I want to go and see, you know, that feeling you get when you're in a rock concert or something like that, where you feel like you're part of something, like this is historical. I mean, it's trivial perhaps, but that feeling of we are now in history, historical time. Or people say, I'm going to go, you know, I don't know, maybe in Britain, I don't know the example, but Jeremy Corbyn is speaking in his leadership race, and I want to go and listen to him speak. Because if I go and listen to him speak, I've stepped into history. And then I step out of the room and I'm back to my unhistorical life, anti-historical life. They make history, we just sort of slither through life, you know. That's the third option we are left with, is a kind of, we want to go and enjoy a rock concert just to feel that feeling of being important as a mirror of somebody else's importance. Otherwise, we are just nothing. So the left has to provide an alternative to that. That, I think, is one of our main failings. And I remember after the big election when we got basically walked over, which is 2014 Lok Sabha election, there was a lot of critique of the left saying you don't have an answer to people's aspirational desires. People are aspiring, what is your answer? Your answer is always a critique. This is bad, that's wrong, corruption. I actually think that's not the correct critique of the left, that it's not aspirational. The question isn't to answer the what I think of as the illusionary aspirations of a mall culture. It's the deeper spiritual, moral dilemma that people face. And I think we've forgotten that over the course of the last 100 years, that, you know, in when the socialist movement develops, it's an ethical challenge to society. It's not merely a critique of, you know, the fat cats. I mean, and in fact, the language they used was so moral. You know, they critique the system with such moral outrage. You see that on the stump. But our intellectuals are no longer morally outraged about anything. They write bloodlessly. You know, our journalists are not outraged. I mean, I'm talking about the leftist journalists. They write bloodlessly. You know, they're so deeply concerned to appear balanced that they just can't reach people and say, look, believe in something, friends. So I think that spirit, I mean, I'm calling it spiritual, but really it's an answer to that. That's one thing that we really must strive for. Linked to that is, I think, an honest appraisal of our history. You know, okay, you had, you know, next year is the anniversary of the Russian Revolution. I will celebrate it with a great deal of enthusiasm because it was an incredible event in world history. But the question that we might want to consider is, was it inevitable that the Russian Revolution leads to barrack socialism? You know, I mean, listen, Lenin didn't stand up there and say, let's, comrades, let's make a country where we live in buildings that are gray and unpainted and where nobody is allowed to dissent and, you know, come on, that's not the socialism. Is it inevitable? I'm not sure. Is it because they were suffocated by powers outside? Partly, but that's not enough of an explanation. Other things are to be considered. For instance, you know, one of the interesting counterpoints to the Russian Revolution, which is not as dramatic because A, it's smaller, B, it doesn't have the same kind of other revolutions in El Salvador and Nicaragua. Those were revolutions. We don't see them as revolutions because when they seized power, they didn't say all other parties banned. They allowed parties to use. Venezuela is a third example. You know, people in the West like to say Venezuela is authoritarian. If it was authoritarian, they would have closed down all the right-wing TV channels. They would have banned all the parties, but they didn't. They allowed them to campaign, and that's how they lost the legislative election. So one of the thing, penalties we are paying is that the one when the party becomes the state, becomes everything, it creates a kind of suffocation. There needs to be the, whether you are a party of the left or liberals, you need to fight for the hearts and minds of people. You cannot take them for granted. You take them for granted, then you administer socialism like medicine. You know, open your mouth, here's a dose of... That's not socialism. Socialism means the party has to continue to struggle against other forces to win the hearts. We have to be honest about this, that one of the great disasters, I think, of the experiments was the turn to one-party rule. And one-party rule nowhere is being successful because a party ossifies. And it forgets that human beings, you know, need to feel like they're part of movements and, you know, struggles. And so I think those are the kinds of things that we need to be doing. But listen, this honesty is okay. The real thing is we need to be able to encourage a movement consciousness that says there are already alternatives. I mean, Bloch's line, which is so great, is that tomorrow is alive today. You know, great. It's another slogan, like another world is possible. Actually, it's not like another world is possible. Another world is possible says you have to wait for it. Or you struggle, but it'll come. Bloch's line is that tomorrow is alive today. There's another interesting mark, I'm just throwing out slogans. But Mahdi Amel, the great Lebanese Marxist, had a great line where he said, you are not defeated when you are resisting. You know, this culture of resistance and faith in the capacity of humans to improve their lives in front of us. You know, why I reported from the Syrian refugee camps. These refugee camps, they are a miserable situation. People are despondent. But then right outside the tent, they grow flowers. You know, I mean, they are beautifying the area. Human beings are incredible. And I don't think we do enough as people on the left to champion the amazing resilience and fortitude of human beings. You know, we take people for granted sometimes. But every individual who's there is important. You know, it's not... When we talk about classes, it should not abstract human capacity. You know, it should be... This is analytical and then this is our movement. Our movement is a human movement.
Yeah.
You know, so that's how I would say.
Yeah, I mean, that means retrieving the humanistic aspects of socialism that were in the 19th century articulated by Marx himself in his early phase. That's what he wrote about initially. And then, you know, a range of other figures from William Morris to Robert Owen who were not really talking about socialism as a revolutionary movement that's going to seize state power and then create a dictatorship of the proletariat. They were talking about the flowering of, you know, individuality, the flowering of the individual self within, you know, communities, within particular communities. So, you know, the notion of the individual, which becomes so important starting the 18th century, the individual with his rights, with her freedoms, that is constantly at the center of everything they're thinking and writing about. And it's not particularly future-oriented either. It's about ensuring the dignity and freedom of individuals within that particular moment. I think, you know, Marxism and socialism enter a different phase altogether when they enter electoral politics or, you know, start thinking about revolution or seizure of state power. Then they become something different altogether. I mean, and in many cases end up cancelling their own high ideals, and which is a sort of, you know, the one of the most grotesque ironies of actually existing socialism in the last 150 years. So I think it is possible for that early humanistic core of socialistic thinking to be retrieved and brought into an interesting relationship with the ideas of individualism prevailing today, because I mean, I think it's pretty clear that old state structures or old collective projects of the kind that we saw manifested in either revolutionary states, communist states, or indeed post-colonial states, they are dead. and they will not come back again. Partly because I think the revolution of individualism is now universal. The demand for freedoms that cannot be stopped. I mean, that I think in that's where Tocqueville was much more perceptive than Marx. That he saw what was happening in America, and he knew that everything will collapse before it. But how to channel that particular energy and aspiration to a more just and humane society? I mean, I think that is the challenge for the left today.
I mean, I'll give you an example. Firstly, by the way, you know, we all have these traditions. You know, long before, 100 years before Morris, Akbar Allahabadi, one of the great unread poets of our, I mean, what was his Qawwalis that have come from his thing. One of the great poems of his, in a fabulous Qawwali, is "Admi tha badi mushkil se insaan hua." We were people with great difficulty, we became human. You know, the project of becoming human is the project of socialism. You know, it's what Adorno said, we are in prehistory. History hasn't started yet. We live in a kind of animalistic era. We will become human at some point. You know, I'll just tell you a story. About maybe 10 years ago, I went with some ADWA activists, the All India Democratic Women's Association activists, to Haryana. And, I mean, if those who have traveled in rural India will recognize that about 15, 20 years ago, even landless peasants, so-called landless peasants, who hired themselves out to landowners, near their homes used to have small plots of land where they would grow vegetables and things for subsistence. And they could, you know, and in fact, it would enrich their diet. So you'd eat grain, but then you could get whatever vegetable, some saag or something to, you know, so you don't get scurvy. Onions, they would grow little things. What I found amazing, 10, 12 years ago maybe, in a very prosperous Haryana village, where the story that we had come to see was that landless women had no place to take a crap. So the land where they used to go to the bathroom was now contested. And the landlord's people used to stand there and basically fire above their heads when they came to use the land, you know, to defecate or urinate or whatever. The crackdown on landless people's minuscule holdings, these kind of common land which they would cultivate or go to the bathroom on, the crackdown on that has been so severe that the struggle that ADWA was leading there was the right essentially to pee, you know, was the struggle. This is a communist women's group, 14 million members. They were not leading a struggle for wages, and they were leading a dignity struggle, but also a struggle over property, because the landowners were basically grabbing all the village land by force of arms, backed by the cops and everybody. So why am I doing this kind of story about an answer to de Tocqueville? Essentially, the kind of beneath the desires of, in, you know, freedoms and things like that, the conditions of being able to meet those freedoms has deteriorated so dramatically in so many parts of the world that the politics has to be, you know, there was a time in the left, a debate between, you know, what Nancy Fraser called redistribution versus recognition was the kind of debate. You know, this was identity politics versus whatever class. This debate is meaningless because in Haryana, for instance, how can you organize peasant women, landless women as peasants, unless you deal with their dignity questions? So what's begun to happen, Pankajan, which I think is actually very positive, is that some of these older debates are disappearing. And I think there's an understanding now that questions of dignity are actually at the forefront of building the capacity, of building confidence among people to be part of movements. Because it's very hard to come to people and say, let's join, make a movement of landless peasants. People are traveling 3-4 hours by train to go and work in fields where they don't know they'll get hired. So where will you organize them? At the train station? At the farms where they're roaming around begging to get work? So this is a kind of, so instead you're organizing them on dignity, because dignity is a class issue. You know, certain people don't have to think about the indignity of being shot at while you're taking a pee. So in that sense, there are multiple kinds of aspirations. You know, and multiple kinds of America, let's say. The kind of America of de Tocqueville that we have to be very careful to identify and actually engage people in their aspirations. Yeah. And I think, that's why a left anywhere in the global south has to be acutely aware of questions of, you know, gender, questions of basic everyday walking down the street issues, harassment. These are socialist issues. And I think for at least a couple of generations, the debate has been so intense between identity and class. And the, you know, how is it that the dignity of a working class person is not a class question? Like, I've often been flummoxed by the idea that, say, somebody who's a Dalit, you know, and they are landless farmers, the question of a Dalit issue, you know, let's say, right to walk down a street, that's a class question as much as anything. But I don't mean to say that by saying it's not a Dalit question. It's precisely a Dalit question. And it's a question for the whole neighborhood there of landless people, because if you have a divided working class, you have a defeated working class, basically. So that idea of aspiration, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to this thing about how to cultivate, you know, but the aspirations are so divided. And I fear that in a world where the rural is becoming less in our consciousness, even though the bulk of people live there, we don't understand the aspirations anymore. And I don't even know I don't know how many people care about, read books set in rural areas. I mean, do novels set in rural areas sell anymore?
Or even written anymore.
Or are they written anymore? Yeah, I don't think people care.
That's a very good question, actually. I think you will find that they are not. Mostly because writers don't actually have much access to that reality anymore. There was a time when writers used to live in the countryside. All the great writers of the 19th century live in the countryside. Tolstoy, Flaubert. Then you had, you know, this movement to the cities, and now it's only a very particular kind of writer who, you know, actually spends any time in the countryside. So the metropolis has become the place that producers of culture want to be, and that's why, and one reason why rural India has kind of vanished from our imaginations.
Imagine that we grew up reading Premchand.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I mean, for the Hindiwalas, that was the thing, and now,
yeah,
you know, Chetan Bhagat. I mean, it's a descent of letters.
Yeah.
You know, the one South Asian who writes on rural issues is that Pakistani writer, but he's running his farm, right?
Daniel
Hussain. Yeah. I like the stories a lot.
Yeah, but they are from another time.
Yeah.
Those stories belong to the 1960s when his father was running that farm. And he kept a memoir. So the stories are drawn from
that. I didn't realize that.
So that's why they have such a dated feel. It's very much a feudal Pakistan of the 1960s.
Okay.
It's not this very angry Punjab that we see today.
Correct.
You know, there isn't a single fundamentalist in those stories, which is very strange. If you're thinking about it, set in the present.
Well, I would, if I was living in Pakistan, the most interesting stories are in rural Pakistan.
Yeah.
I mean, similarly in North India, I mean, the most interesting stories are that what Jan Breman called footloose labor, which sort of goes between rural and urban and makes a mockery of the divide.
Absolutely.
And, you know, people are puzzled. You know, I ride the purple line in Delhi. You use a purple line from, you know, that goes down to Badarpur, and the whole lot of basically migrant colonies.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's a fascinating journey because as the train comes up to Lajpat Nagar, the different group enters or doesn't enter because of this. It's a meeting of two different Delhis.
Not quite the F train.
But anyway.
Should we open this up?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Please, I don't know.
Comments, questions.
Yeah.
That question, I'll ask the first question. You mentioned, at some point, you mentioned the desire for return to a sort of like homogenized society, and you later on quickly talked about gender, and I wondered like to what extent you might explain articulations of the desire for social change in a very gendered way. They're deeply masculine, right? Or how would you explain them?
Okay. Why would you say desires for change are masculine?
Just the ones that you were referring to. You were referring to America, India, and Turkey.
Ah, I see. The ones with the strong man syndrome. That is not... that's a phenomenon that exists there. I mean, I'm merely describing the phenomenon. But I don't think that's a necessity for society. You know, society doesn't necessarily produce this as the only way forward. But, you know, there has been a resurgence of this kind of strongman feeling. People have explained it in all kinds of ways. You know, one is the question that feminism has put on the table, suggesting that questions of equality, and this is a kind of, you know, revanchism of men in these societies. You know, so those have been some explanations that have been put out there. They may have some truth. I don't, you know, want to get into that itself. But I think this idea of loss that we talked about, and the how do you answer people feeling that there is no hope? And one is, of course, technocracy. You know, that a technocrat can solve it. You know, why should we elect people who don't know how to run the economy? By the way, the next Indian finance minister most likely will be Subramanian Swamy. So you can say goodbye to India even more. Although he's supposed to be an economist.
He's supposed to. He's supposed to be a lot of things.
He is a lot of things. So, you know, one is technocracy, but the other is the phenomena of the strong man. Why it has emerged in that way, I think, is a very complicated question. But I really do think some of it has to do with the entry of questions of feminism. You know, when Erdogan first came to power, when he first came to the election, one of the early things they pushed for was the strengthening of the traditional family. You know, payments for the extra child. You know, and this is things that his old Anatolian base had wanted in previous governments. Because they saw that what they called Istanbul had been ruining the so-called traditional family. And there was a real pushback against this. And I think this is there. I mean, you know, you've written a book about small town India, which is a great book. I mean, I think small town India resentment at, say, Bombay may be similar, but not identical. I mean, the Turkish story is very interesting. That, again, it's not that much talked about how Erdogan pushed this family agenda in his first few years. You know, he was very careful. He didn't go after the military. He didn't go after the power structure. Why? Because, and he knew, by the way, that the military, let me back up. One of the things Erdogan goes for immediately in Turkey was membership in the EU. But he's a very clever guy. He knew that if he gets membership in the EU, the military will not be able to do a coup. Because by EU rules, you'll get suspended if there's a military coup. And I think the elite was eager for entry into EU. So the EU, he showed a kind of liberalism in the early period outside to get into the European, to cut the military back. But meanwhile, he went after the, you know, progressive social movements by strengthening the family, putting money into this, these so-called welfare payments. You know, it's disguised as welfare payments. Actually, it's reconstructing a fantasy of the traditional family. So there was you're right, there's a crackdown at the women's movement, which is, you know, a powerful social entity in Turkey. And India is so much more complicated because even the BJP is not as homogenous as the AKP. I mean, the AKP is so homogenous that Erdogan fires his loyal prime minister. You know, I mean, it's unbelievable. This guy has done his bidding all the way. He had one minor disagreement, got rid of him.
But I do think the question of gender is quite interesting in this context.
because change has been often conceived as a masculine project. I mean, I think even if you go back and look at the journalism of the French Revolution, for instance, women's place is very much sit at home and sew uniforms for the revolutionaries. Napoleon has the most retrograde views about women. Their place is very much in the household, and a series of figures, even some of the most liberal political figures or thinkers or activists of the 19th century, have this notion of women as essentially facilitators of their projects, but in a subordinate, particularly subordinate position. And I think now, with all kinds of uncertainties about employment, about education, about livelihood, there is this corresponding craving for, you know, a kind of manliness.
So how do you explain Thatcher then?
How do you explain Thatcher?
I mean, you know, she was a strong...
Yeah, I'm not saying that you know, that the craving for strength cannot be manifested by...
Yeah, but Hillary Clinton, I mean,
yeah.
It can be, you know...
Well, Hillary Clinton's whole kind of, you know, essentially she's staked this image of being tough and the sort of commander-in-chief. Absolutely, yeah. So people have, you know, Indira Gandhi, so many people have continuously assumed role, except that India is actually different because women have a particular position which allowed in... mythology and in the culture at large, which allows, for instance, the BJP to think of women as people who can go out on the streets, preach, you know, they're firebrand preachers. But at the same time, they have the older construction with Erdogan would approve of the family and their, you know, women's role in the family. So there are variations all over the place, but there is a particular notion of women that a lot of these modernizers, nationalists, revolutionaries share, which I think makes it a, you know, really knotty, complicated issue.
Yeah.
And I think one reason why we see an exponential rise in misogyny on social media, particularly where it's most manifest and egregious, I think it's because of this kind of sense of powerlessness and this desire to assert your strength and power by running down women. And there's also that kind of always, and particularly in the United States, that for a fear of women going to the workplace and taking your jobs away and being in positions of authority, that also is, I think, hard for a lot of, you know, men to deal with.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah.
I'd like to come back to ideas of dissent. Because I think, for example, if we think about Judith Butler's idea of vulnerability as a human resource, and we think of some of the disability movements, if we think of LGBT struggles, all this way of thinking to counter kind of gendered ideas of strength and weakness and so on, this idea of vulnerability as something that is a resource. And I'd just be interested in your comments around some of those linking up into solidarity around struggles around sexuality, disability, difference in that way. Any comments from you both?
Yeah, listen, that's a very good question, because I mean, one of I think this, it's great that you asked this after this first question, because I mean, you're quite correct that there is a very great element in all kinds of progress-oriented movements to believe. In fact, the idea of better has often been a synonym for strength. That, you know, now the working class will be strong, or somebody will be strong, and, you know, we'll rule in a strong way. I mean, the strong man, by the way, is not just of the right, but also of the left. I mean, the strength has been, vitality is the other word, has been a very key term. So I think you're right, there is it is in the camp of vitality that the future is envisioned. But of course, that's a lie. You know, whoever is making that claim, that's as much a lie as saying that I'm going to squeeze the throat and it'll cough out jobs. You know, it doesn't quite happen like that. Our societies aren't vital in that sense. Our societies are complicated. You know, people are strong in one venue and not strong in another. And, you know, they have multiple identities themselves. Nobody is a singular person. So our movements have to enrich ourselves by everybody's contribution. And I think that's something that has taken, you know, our movements, let's say now just our movements, over 100 years to learn that lesson. That it's not a question of, I think vulnerability as a resource is a nice phrase. But people are not just vulnerable. They are vulnerable here, they are not vulnerable there. I mean, I much prefer the idea that people are very complicated. And it's that full complexity that should be part of our movement. So, you know, one of the interesting parts of that is that our agendas, that's why I talk always about dignity, you know. Our agendas have to be as wide as possible. I mean, you know, it's so fascinating that in the West, let's say in outside the southern European zone, there was this great fascination with Syriza and Podemos, and, you know, I used to read about, you know, the Guardian, all these papers just were so excited, you know, this Podemos. Did you read any articles about the HDP in Turkey? Well, barely covered. Who cares, you know, in Turkey, HDP, what is that? I mean, this Turkish political party, which denied Erdogan the right to have a massive majority in the thing, has the most socially progressive platform, which is why in parts of the predominantly Kurdish area, they lost a lot of the vote, because there were sections of conservative Kurdish society saying, what is this party, you know, that is actually campaigning actively for gay rights, actively for LGBT visibility in society, you know, actively campaigning. In India, for instance, it's the communists that have taken fully on board this wide social agenda, you know, complete rejection of the colonial laws against sodomy. It's actually not a law against homosexuality. The 3677 is a law against sodomy. So, I mean, these movements in the South have actually taken the lessons of multiplicity of people and the importance of imagining today the complexity of our society in the future, where one group does not or should not be seen as the dominant group, what we, you know, some normative group. There is no such thing. You know, it is a complex world that we live in. It will be a complex society in the future. It's not going to homogenize in any way. I think it would be good for us to pay attention to some of these movements in the South that have actually learned the lesson. What happens typically is the assumption is these are northern lessons, which the South has not yet learned. Actually, I would suggest that these movements have learned the lessons and have put it on their platform. So, you know, the HDP platform is much more progressive than the Labour Party platform. But, you know, it doesn't get covered at all. So I 100% agree. But the phrase, I'm not keen on it, you know, vulnerability as a resource, because it assumes that certain people are vulnerable. Whereas I think we are all vulnerable. And I think that's, unless that's what the phrase means, and I think we need to inhabit both our vulnerabilities and our strength. You know, it makes us more human, it makes us able to have dialogue better. Because if I believe I have no vulnerability, how will I listen to people?
Just to
contextualize. Yeah, sorry.
She used it in the context post 9/11, where exactly this idea of the aggressive response, and she was countering the idea of vulnerability as a human resource for all of us, exactly the complexity of our identities, and that's why I linked it to struggles around disability, our health, how we think about mental health, those kinds of different.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, you know, I was, by the way, quite shocked. I don't follow British politics at all. I mean, but I was quite shocked. I had heard a lot about Ian Duncan Smith, and that somebody like that resigns from
government. What had you heard about him?
Huh?
What had you heard about him?
I heard that, you know, he was a guy who was taking the idea of social welfare and kind of making it, finding ways to privatize, you know, so the entire domain of social welfare. Because if you're a right-wing party, you can't not deal with the fact that there will be people who need certain kinds of social assistance. You know, even right-wing parties can't be so heartless. At least that's the imagination you have. You know, you can't. So I was under the impression he was the guy creating the agenda of how to have a social welfare party for a right-wing, you know. And then he then resigned saying this You know, I could just hear the sound of the British population, no longer the fat being cut, but the bone being scraped off. You know, it could only be this bad if this guy resigned. So, I mean, I think that the idea of, you know, we all require support at different points in our life. But certain supports are different from others, you know. And I think that richness has to be part of our vocabulary.
Yes. So you were talking, both of you earlier, about critiquing the left and what it might need to learn. You were talking about the idea of the strong man, but it's, you know, the 30th anniversary of the Cultural Revolution, the idea of the strong man and the idea of communal forces and frenzied attacks have been part of the left as well, and that might well be a part of why those of us who perhaps sympathise with your critique of right-wing capitalism don't feel that we can engage in this, because we're afraid of what those forces that you talk about experiencing at the rock concert or the Corbyn rally. I find them,
you don't think the comparison is too bad though?
No, it's
a good comparison. Okay.
If you're talking about, I'm frightened of words like solidarity, because they can be turned, can't they, so easily by somebody with rhetoric. And I think what we see in sort of a fracturing of the left is that people now concentrate on the idea of difference or your own identity or protecting your little sort of niche of things. And I think it's because people feel a bit safer in protecting their own identity in that way than they do with communal movements. I don't have any answers to this. This is just raising the question.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I suppose I was trying to say this earlier, when we talked about collectivist orientations, which, you know, essentially politics in the past was defined as a sort of essentially a collectivist project, and that's why you have this crisis early in the 20th century in Europe, and then of course with projects like Mao's project. But we cannot go back to them anymore, because this notion of individual freedom now exists universally. So the idea that the old state with this command structure, with this, you know, man essentially, or someone like Stalin or Mao, forcing everyone to join this particular mode of solidarity, forcing them to do all kinds of things against their elders, against their friends, I think that's extremely unlikely to happen, simply because I think, you know, the way in which we conceive of ourselves in the world has shifted dramatically, and so much of both the promises and the dangers of the situation come from this fact. The promises are that perhaps, you know, there's a way of thinking again about political action, and perhaps this is what you're trying to do, which takes into account the fact that there has been this explosion of individualism, the fact that there is the idea of the individual is now a universal one.
Can I leave something? No, I'm interrupting.
Yeah, please.
Straight in there and either disagree or at least be worried about that disagree. Because I just thought one of the most frightening things about Trump or someone like that is that there's, you refer to them as this kind of seething body of people who are all individuals and nerds, and you can read it on social media all the time, but would just love to get this collectivist movement where, and this surely is the point of the strong man, that you abandon you lend your individuality to the strong man, and then you don't need to worry anymore. So it's an individual truth, but I'd rather just forget about it for a bit because someone else will look after me. Isn't that the point?
Yeah, I mean, you're right. So it has its dangers, that moment, you know, and actually, Doc Wheel actually pointed this out, that with the rise of individualism, you also open up a new scope for despotism of this kind. So he kind of anticipated Trump 100 years ago,
that people would want to sacrifice their powers of cognition and simply, you know, ascend to a strong figure like that because he promises equality. I mean, that's a great kind of promise of the modern era, that a man like that would just impose equality even at the cost of their individual liberty. So there is that danger there.
I would doubt that, because he promises the opportunity not to have to worry about what you do with your individuality anymore.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, he does promise that. But at the same time, I mean, one also has to acknowledge that America is also going through an interestingly democratic process. I mean, the fact that the older structures are being hollowed, and this is also happening in India, they are being hollowed out. In fact, they've been hollowed out to the extent where they are kind of more or less collapsed in the case of the Republican Party, and that's why it has thrown up a candidate like Donald Trump. But what is also happening is a different kind of democracy, which is really, you know, in the kind of democracy that we can welcome, which is that individuals are actually coming together and have come together in protests, often articulating, you know, grievances, aspirations, often grievances that are shared by people on the other side, but doing them differently. So there is this, you know, possibility of democracy happening differently at the same time that we see someone like Trump essentially, you know, trying to set up a soft despotism. So it can work both ways, this particular, you know, way of extremely individualized societies, which we also now see in India. I mean, the whole election 2 years ago was fought on the premise that, you know, India now exists of individuals, that we are breaking free of all hierarchies, and anyone who can promise to meet their particular aspirations, which were mostly for, you know, better malls, which were conceived as such, for better malls, essentially better consumption, is going to succeed. And Modi proved that part of the equation. But now we are witnessing the other side, which is that, you know, there are now people, individuals who are unlikely to, you know, fall for a kind of Modi-like phenomena or the old socialist, communist distortion of collectivist projects. So I think we are in an interesting moment.
But you see, this idea of, you said something very nice, which you said, I'm afraid of the word solidarity. Now, what are we to tell? I'm just going back to the story because it's a vivid story for me. What am I to tell those women who can't go into the bathroom? What are we to give them as an alternative? The ballot box is going to do zero for them. You know, it doesn't work like that. I mean, Haryana politics are very dangerous and dirty. Violence suffuses the political domain, just as it is there in this social interaction between these people. So in that sense, these women and men have to build power. And the building of power is part of politics. Now, there are at least two ways in which power is built. One way in which power is built is it is built, let us say, anarchically, where the situation gets so atrocious that people just go and burn down the landlord's house. And, you know, there's historical evidence going back hundreds of years, maybe thousands of years, of this kind of building power. Now, we know this kind of building power is extraordinarily transient. There is a joy in watching the landlord's house burn down. The next day, it's either this landlord or some other landlord that's going to come and just slaughter you. You know, and the evidence of this, of course, again, is thousands of these incidents happen in India now. So you have to say that road to building power is not effective for people. Even though it's, you know, you can neither command it nor can you stop it. You know? Because people will do it. They'll get in such a position of frustration, they'll go and hurt somebody. But there's another way in which power is built, and that's organizationally. But that's an extraordinarily risky maneuver. You know, the history of building organizations among rural wretched, let's say the wretched of the rural earth, is extremely dangerous. I mean, people get killed all the time trying to build peacefully. You know, I mean, how many peaceful organizers have been killed in rural India over the last 100 years? You know, we don't have those books, we don't have those names. I wish I could have a list of names of these people. I mean, just now, in Chhattisgarh, Bela Bhatia and Shalini Gira, I mean, they were running a legal aid office, basically, where people were coming in for legal advice. They were, as we say in India, externed. In no other country do they use the word externed, do they? You can be interned in prison or you can be externed from the district. You know, it's a British colonial thing, they extern you. They have been externed from Chhattisgarh. You know, I mean, so what I'm just trying to get at is, I understand, you say that the word solidarity is scary. Yes, well, if somebody's going to come and burn your house down, I can see that that's scary. The other side of it is, when people are organized, it is also disruptive socially. You know, Martin Luther King had a great line in the letter from Birmingham jail. He said, there is a negative peace that exists in the world today. You know, it appears like peace, but the cost of this peace is being borne by too many people. So he was told by these conservative preachers who said, don't do things so quickly, slow down. And he, in the letter from Birmingham jail, he says, slow down, what do you mean? What do you mean slow down? You know, I cannot tolerate the negative peace. So any agitation, it is after all agitation, is going to stir the pot of power relations. And it's extremely messy. So whether it's through the ballot box, which is a very difficult place, or it's merely building power. And by the way, building power, I just mean an office for a union will get firebombed by the landlords. The organizers will be...
The way you speak about things, it's all very sort of, you know, you've got your landlords here,
yeah,
and you've got your oppressed people there, and it's this battle between them. I just don't see that that is... It's a huge simplification. We've seen how many left-wing governments and movements that you've been saying have started off with these same ideals and have just crushed other people who they believe to be in their way.
Well, okay, so, no, but this is a, you're also collapsing two very different issues. One is, you know, by the way, building power is also a liberal exercise. It's not merely a left-wing exercise. I mean, why do you have political parties in a democracy? Why not have people just run as individuals and have people vote individually? No, you build a political party in order to consolidate a certain set of the public into a platform that people generally agree with, and then use the power of that collectivity to campaign for your views against other people, and you test it at the ballot box. That's also building power. I'm telling you, I can give you many stories of actual places where merely the setting up of an office in rural India is attacked. Because there are indeed landlords. I mean, that's not a simplification. There are people who own the land. They don't really want this road to be opened up. It is actually far better for them to have people get so frustrated that they lash out. And then you can turn the economic grievances into a security question. You know, this happens in Mexico, for instance, where you have NAFTA. NAFTA comes and basically destroys the corn industry. So then you get a large number of farmers turned to drugs. You know, what they call in Sinaloa province, gomeros. Gomeros are those who grow opium. There was a farmer, Ernesto Guzman, who used to have cattle, small farm. He became a gomero. His son is El Chapo Guzman, the big leader of the Sinaloa cartel. But his dad used to have cattle. But NAFTA basically destroyed these farmers. Then they become drug smugglers. Now, instead of addressing the economic grievance, you start a war on drugs. So our governments today like to make economic grievances into security threats. So now what are people supposed to do?
But they also, I'm also interested in the political implications of what you're saying. If you're saying, if you're arguing that solidarity leads straight to the gulag, solidarity leads straight to the Cultural Revolution and Mao Zedong, let's use a different word. What about sympathy, which is a form of solidarity? What about compassion? Do they also lead to the gulag? Should we stop feeling them? I mean, there are other examples, not part of the... Can I finish? Not part of the left argument. Let's stick to India. Indigenous peoples fighting large corporations who want to essentially take over their land. There's a very famous case of Vedanta based here in London. And this community in Niyamgiri fought for the right to live where they've been living for several generations. There was no particular left connection there. These were tribal peoples, not organized, not mobilized. But they were acting out of solidarity. Would you say they should not act because they might end up staging a cultural revolution or putting people in gulag? What is the political implication of this argument? I'm curious. I mean, I'm genuinely interested.
Maybe the answer is...
Just not do anything.
No, but maybe... No. And all the individual examples you can give, I'm sure have the justice on their side. But what I'm saying is that it's... If we're talking about a critique of the left, then we have to be honest in saying that the same urges exist within human beings when they talk about there's this group of, well, you know, drug dealers and drug gangs, it's the fault of NAFTA, which is the fault of America. I mean, that seemed to me as simplified an argument you were making as the one that you were saying about, you know, any solidarity leads to the gulag. I don't believe that to be the case. But maybe the this idea of progress or poetry of the future, or whatever Marx called it, is in fact... it always seems very vague. So my question is, what does the revolution look like? If I want to sign up to it, what would it actually be like?
But no one is advocating revolution. I mean, we talked about how the revolution is not possible, and we said the revolutionary state is not possible, the revolutionary movement is not possible. So I think you may be attacking a straw dog here. I mean, the left has been turned into a straw dog, and it's unfortunate that the disasters of the Soviet experiment or the Maoist experiment have managed to discredit a whole range of possibilities, of emotions, of ideas, to the point that solidarity is now a word under suspicion. And that is, you know, part of the problem that we live with today. We talked about that.
Penalty.
Yeah, it's a penalty pay. But I do think that if we are to think of ourselves in this wider world as living, thinking, feeling human beings, necessarily dependent on others, necessarily dependent on wider structures for our existence to be possible, then we do have to think about solidarity. We do have to think about sympathy and compassion and stop fighting these Cold War battles and stop thinking in Cold War categories as, you know, something always leading to something else. Like,
I'm just pointing out that I'm not going to say all these other people should say what they...
No, I mean, your point is well taken. I think the fact is that we have already...
I'm not going to turn to that and say, you know, I mean, if you're talking about the critique of the left, you have to think about what happened. You can't just say it was an unfortunate mistake.
No, I don't think anybody
says that.
I thought I had given quite a robust... mine is a critique of both the history and of Friedrich Hayek. You should read Hayek's book. Hayek's book is called 1944, The Road to Serfdom. Hayek argued any attempt to create justice in the world leads to the gulag. That was Hayek's book, 1944. It's called The Road to Serfdom. It's a very provocative argument, one with which, of course, I don't agree at all. But the essence of his ethical position was, therefore, don't strive for justice in a project. And then the economic implication of that is, let the market take care of it. The market is a better predictor of redistribution than any human being. You know, by the way, Mamata Banerjee today said, we are against man-made corruption. Which I thought is interesting. Because the other corruption is okay. Man-made corruption we are against. So man-made justice is bad. But market justice we can tolerate.
See, I wonder. Like, yeah. This is sorry. So it's an issue of the market.
We've only got one question. Time for one more question. I think that was.
I've had my hand up since the very beginning. So I'll make it brief. I ask myself often, where's the fight? And I ask that in two ways. One way I think of it tactically, and I think, is the fight taking place in the market? Is the fight taking place in government? Is it in the countryside? Where exactly is the fight? But then I also ask myself in relation, I work at a university, and I ask in terms of students, where is the fight in young people? Where is the fight? That moral outrage that you were speaking of earlier. So when I ask myself that question, the answer, usually, I do not find the answer in this notion of powerlessness or hopelessness. I find it more in a notion of complacency. And that is something that I see is quite common among young people, and I'm from Egypt, and increasingly in Egypt as well, largely as a result there. It's a mix of the hopelessness and the powerlessness because of the coup, but then also the sense of complacency, that I'm busy with something else. And that something else ends up being, to me, consumerism and materialism. And it's almost as if that has substituted for the fight. So there still is this notion of progress, but the progress that we understood historically is very different from the progress that we understand today, which is a new iPhone, or a new laptop, or a bigger house. And it almost seems as if that is now what is in place. So the fight that is being waged is merely a fight for consumption. So when you bring in this notion of politics and fighting for others, and even solidarity becomes a bad word.
But I actually feel, firstly, I'll just clarify, I think every generation, we were talking about this earlier, you know, wondering during the Indian freedom struggle, how many millions of Indians just went along with their jobs?
Right.
You know, in 1968, a group of students go and do crazy things, the rest of them are sitting and studying. You know, they're following Dipesh Chakrabarty's advice, don't struggle, only study. You know, you see, my point is we should not also exaggerate. You know, these movements. And sometimes it's actually for young people to listen to the stories of the past is very demoralizing, because they say, well, we don't have a 1968. Well, look, if you actually allowed the camera to pull back, there was this Tariq Ali on a soapbox, 50 people standing there, and then there was people just walking to their classes. But the camera is focused on the 50, so you think there's 70,000 people there, the whole of London is there. So that's one issue, that, you know, we really shouldn't demoralize ourselves. You know, Lenin in 1914 at the Zimmerwald, they turned to one of his friends and said, you know, the real revolution in the world will fit in a train car. You know, there's so few of us. That was the Zimmerwald. There were like 15, 18 people there. Look, the point is that this is a greatly demoralized moment. For all kinds of reasons, you know, every time there is hopefulness, it gets crushed. But, you know, the role of, I think, and I'm going to use these old-fashioned words, the role of revolutionaries or, you know, I don't know, radicals or what, agitators, these are all decent words. These people's role, our role, is to explain to as many people as possible why something like the Arab Spring rose and collapsed. What is going on in Latin America? I mean, the issue that I think is important is to try to create narratives of hope and to explain collapse. That is our responsibility. You know, our responsibility isn't merely to yell at people in power, but it's to pivot and turn to other people and say, look, there are other explanations. You know, what's happening in Venezuela, that's not the full story. And I don't mean to say the story is hidden, you know, whatever. I don't mean that. I mean, let's put it in a different context. Let's shift the conversation. That's very much the role of radicals and revolutionaries. If you go back to the history of the left was to be an alternative media. Why do every leftist groups have a newspaper? I mean, it gets irritating in countries like here. They keep trying to sell you their paper. Why do you create a newspaper? Why? Because you understand you're actually fighting a game to interpret reality. It's a matter of interpretation as much as anything. Because, you know, what the reality the news media feel isn't a lie. It's understanding of what's happening. We have to provide our own understanding, and it has to be robust enough that people say, well, look, you know, your explanation for this makes sense to me. That doesn't really make sense to me. Now let's talk more. How do we prevent these failures? So that's how I would understand the role of journalism, teaching, writing. I mean, our role is essentially not as people to convince. I don't go around trying to convince people. I'm not trying to convince you to do something. I want to give you a story that you then say, you know, there are bits of it that make sense to me. Some of it doesn't, some does. How do I put this story or maybe this view to something else? And then you become part of a movement. You know, our movements now are where everybody, every cook should really govern, meaning everybody in our movement should be a thinker and an actor. This is not a movement where there are some intellectuals and everybody else has to just follow them. That's not how it should be. You know, this is a movement where you really have to promote frameworks and contextual thinking. And one of my greatest criticisms of the academy worldwide is its desiccation. It's removal from the task of being explainers to people and essentially removing itself and then complaining about the world. And the worst is then complaining about the students. You know, you hear that so often.
And writing bad prose.
Our students are there. No, our job as people in the intellectual class is essentially to confront. We have been given this incredible gift in a deeply unequal society. And we should utilize the gift.